Hey, welcome to the Protectors Podcast. We have Justin Cotty. I got it, brother. Did I get it, Justin?
You got it. Right off the gate.
Right off the gate. So everybody, when you have interesting last names like Justin and I, like Piccolo, you get all sorts of just, it's just different. Okay. Like Laura's joining us today, Laura McCord, which is, it's a fairly, you're not going to mess up the McCord, but Justin Cotty. I am super excited for this one because mental health, everybody loves to say, hey, you know what? We're going to talk about mental health. We need to be aware. We need to have this discussion, but to actually take the next step and do something about it. You know, I love talking about mental health, but I am by no means a professional. While I do have my own mental health issues over the past, couple decades, maybe even more than that now, I'm not a professional. But you are becoming a professional, and I'm really excited to talk to you about that today. Justin, welcome to the show.
Right on. Thank you, man. Appreciate that, Jen.
Let's get a little quick snapshot of your background, man. You've had a very interesting one, and I've been told not to call you a officer. You're a deputy. So can you give the 30,000-foot overview of like your past couple decades?
Yeah, sure. So just grew up kind of pretty chill, upper middle class in the Midwest, and then typical American happy family. Parents got divorced when I was 12. And then about a year later, my mom came home from vacation or a business trip and said, hey, I met somebody. We're moving to Canada. I was like, what in the hell? Okay. They live in igloos up there. Midwest kid doesn't know any better. And so I moved to British Columbia. I went to high school up there. Loved it. Great place to live. Graduated high school up there. Started college, hated it. I just wanted to party and, work and make money, I think, at that age. So I was working full time, clubbing every weekend in downtown Vancouver, living my best life. I was 19, 20 years old. And then 9/11 hit, right? And even though I was living in Canada, I was still an American. And so that was devastating to see that, as every American watching the events unfold that day. The towers coming down, people jumping to the opposite of their safety. It was wild, right? And the thing that stuck in my head, though, more than the gruesome and terrible events of that day were the first responders. Ironically enough, I don't come from a family or background of first responders at all. Never had any interest in those careers. But seeing that the only calm of that day was the firefighters, the EMTs, and the cops that were just kind of directing the chaos and helping people. And here at the time, I was living in Canada, working like inside sales, customer service in an office all day, meaningless job. I paid for my hobbies and that was essentially it. But to see a career that you can make money, but also affect, other people around you in a positive way and help them. It's like, wow, I never even thought of those as a career, like I said, but that really stuck with me. And so I started, I don't know if Google was around yet in 2001, but whatever, there was internet, a version of it, AOL dial-up. And so I started doing a little bit of research, on my own into the careers, what they pay and stuff like that. I said, yeah, you get a pension, all these great things, and you get to help people and work outside. Every day is different. So started looking into it, but I was living not quite an hour north of the Washington border. And monetary wise, it just made more sense for me being an American to move down to Washington State. Same scenery, cheaper cost of living and more money for those careers. And so I literally picked up, moved down here. I think it was a month after 9/11 hit, picked up some side jobs. And then before I knew it, I was signed up and volunteering, doing ride-alongs and stuff with Olympia Police Department, and did that for about a year while I worked just kind of side customer service jobs, sort of testing around with some of my history in Canada and lack of judgment decisions kind of shaded me away from some agents, some of the larger agencies, including Olympia. They were like, kid, come back in a couple of years. We'll let you come volunteer, but we're not going to give you a commission quite yet. And so, like I said, I tested for like 8 different agencies and a county here in Washington State, Mason County, took a chance on me. And so I got hired there in 2003, initially as a corrections deputy, and then did that for a few years. And then decided that wasn't really what I wanted. So went out to the road, as a patrol deputy. And then
I'm gonna pause on there real quick.
Yeah.
Because I've always been wondering about this. So not a lot of everybody that jumps into law enforcement has that that itch since they were a kid, the, like, you know, getting a military, law enforcement and stuff like that. When you first, did you play sports in high school?
Defined place. I did, but I wasn't very good. I warmed a lot of benches, but.
But it wasn't like your, like, your, like, life, your adrenaline life. When you first get this job in corrections, man, and you're first, like, coming from this, like, kind of corporate-ish world, you know, even a retail corporate, whatever. And you get these, like, when you're in a CO, you never know what's going to happen. You never know what's around the corner. You're always wondering, like, am I going to get, like, quote unquote shanked? Am I going to get jumped? Am I going to get this? What's that adrenaline like, the dump? Is it like, you're going. And how did you first start dealing with that? Cause I'm like, I know we're kind of talking about mental health later on in the conversation, but I always wondered about that. Like with an initial law enforcement, I'd like to ask Laura that same question.
You know, for me, I didn't, at the time I was, you know, 22 years old still, when I graduated the academy and started being a CO, and I didn't know what any of that was, right? It wasn't until way later in my career, after suffering from anxiety and panic attacks and high blood pressure, that I didn't know what adrenaline dumps were. I'd never been in a fight in my life. And I was a CO for, I think, 2 months, and I got punched in the face and I was like, what the hell? But like you said, then the adrenaline with that and the camaraderie of all your other COs coming to your aid, and the adrenaline was awesome, but like I said, I didn't know what those dumps were. I know I'd be, you know, raging 100%, that adrenaline flowing. And all of a sudden an hour later, after a good night's sleep, and that just happened, now you're exhausted. You can't stop yawning. You know, what the hell is going on? So that's when I got my caffeine addiction of those Red Bulls and those Monsters, which again, now later in life, I know was a big part of those panic attacks, not taking care of yourself and trying to medicate those adrenaline dumps and cortisol dumps and all that. Right. So.
Now, Laura, that must've been like, kind of like a kick in the butt for you too, especially with your background. Not, you know, it's not like, hey, you know what, I'm going to go and serve in combat or do this or do that when you're 12 years old. And then all of a sudden, like, what was your experience like coming out of the academy? And all of a sudden it's like, oh shit.
You know, it's funny because as Justin is talking, I'm like, is he like talking about me? Cause same thing, like no law enforcement in my family. I never thought I'd be wanting to do that. So that was interesting, him mentioning that. But when he said, you know, that first fight, you're like, oh crap. It's interesting because when I went for my interview, that was one of the questions on the panel. It was, hey, have you ever been on a fight? And I'm like, is this a trick question? Are they trying to see if like I can control my anger, or are they trying to see if I can handle myself? So I'm like, I'm just going to go with the honest answer and say, yeah, I have. And so it was interesting to kind of wait for that response, but they were actually wanting to know, because that, you know, is that whole, well, what about that first punch in the face? What are you going to do? Somebody trying to pull a gun on you, how are you going to act? And I mean, you can train somebody all day long, but until you're there, and I'm 5'3". So I'm like working on the south end of the county with people that have been running the streets basically, and they're going to size you up. And what are you going to do? So yeah, that's interesting. They started putting that question on the interview panel, you know.
It's that, you know, you go and you get on the street, you like CO streets or anything like that, but then you start developing your own skill set, your own way to cope, your own way to like live this life, your own way to keep it at, you know, the job or kind of bleed over, but you can't always let it stay at the work. And like later on in your career, you start working like ICAC and officer involved shootings and detectives and all this other stuff. And I know these are, I know like me, I, when my career started going kind of up and down and all around, I really, really like the anxiety started shifting up. I started dealing with it in different ways. Not only did I get, I love it. This is the reality of podcasting. I love to hear a canine in the background.
I've got them locked out too. Sorry.
It's no big deal, but it's like the alcohol, the caffeine, the alcohol, everything else to kind of keep this anxiety. And you're like, you're doing one and then you're doing the other one to low down. And I remember like sitting on my couch and if I could only focus on one thing. And if anything else is going on at the same time, my anxiety would go up and I would grab like I'd drink a big ass glass of rum and Coke, big ass glass of rum and Coke, big ass glass of rum and Coke, and repeatedly. And I was hitting like the Kraken rum every night. I mean, it was going crazy. Cause I couldn't deal with my mental health. I mean, is that like something that, I don't know if you've ever had to deal with that or the people you work with?
Yeah, I mean, I did. So I when I switched from being a CEO to patrol, I just had gotten married at the time, and I was around 26, then 25, going on 26. And so that fizzled out, you know, shocker, being married in your early 20s in law enforcement, working graveyard, didn't work out. That fizzled out pretty quickly. And so here I am, I think I was only on the road on patrol for about a year and a half, going through a divorce, losing my house, and dealing with all those things you just talked about. Self-medicating, you know, nonstop Red Bulls all shift to keep awake during graveyard. Then you come home and you got a slam. For me, it was vodka, because you can't fall asleep otherwise. And so that's actually the exact time frame where I started having panic attacks. And again, uneducated back then, didn't know what they were. I just knew that I would all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it didn't happen during the hot calls. I mean, I'd be in fights, you know, all these things, the homicide calls, whatever it was, and I was fine. It would be the downtimes on shift. I'd just be driving down the side of the road waiting to pick the shag in the next call, and all of a sudden I'm sweating profusely. I'm getting tunnel vision. I couldn't bring myself to be present, to the point where I'd have to pull over. After my third or fourth one, I was in the squad room, and they actually called the paramedics on me because I just wasn't coherent and didn't know what was happening to me until later in life. But self-medicating, not taking care of yourself, and all that, the stress of the job, it adds up quickly for sure. And then later on, yeah, I mean, I lost a handful of coworkers to substance abuse issues and domestic violence, which I can't say for certain, but I can make a safe assumption that those are the issues they were dealing with. And then also two neighboring agency coworkers to suicide as well. It's the unfortunate, you know, elephant in the room in this career.
Well, it's alcohol. And then like when you take that next step, I never took the next step into the other addictive substances, but I can imagine as so many people have. But it's trying to, you know, equate it. And then who do you go to? You know, like I've always been fairly open about it, about like my drinking and everything. And also very, very open about, you know, taking medication to deal with anxiety. But in a lot of agencies, you can't come forward and you can't feel comfortable coming forward. Because to them, they look at you as a liability. And what liability equals is money. And nobody wants to mess with the budget. So is this kind of one of the reasons you're on this path now?
Yeah. I mean, not just the budget. I mean, we're all just line items anyways, right? In these agencies. But I'd say even more so than that is who wants to come forward. And not only you might lose the trust of that brotherhood that you have, you're now a walking liability. Can you be trusted at that next hot call with your coworkers? But also the bigger fear, I think, for a lot of us internally is desk duty, right? Losing your gun, losing your badge, you're unfit for duty and all these things. And then a lot of the issues too, agencies that are doing peer support teams or wellness, there's a lot of labels being thrown out there. It's kind of frustrating. But like my agency had a quote unquote peer support team, which when I first got involved in it, I thought, oh, great. Yeah, this is helpful. But now looking back, knowing what I know, I mean, it was a facade. It was pointless. The people on peer support team, I don't think there was a single deputy looking back. No, there was corporals, detectives, and supervisors. Now, who in their right mind, especially if you're a young, up behind the ear patrol deputy, is going to go to a supervisor? Even a detective is your supervisor as a deputy and say, hey, I have a problem. Yeah, right. And then you want to promote to whatever it is later in your career. I mean, you should be able to and be allowed to, but that stigma is attached to all that. And it's terrible. And I think it's starting to shift the needle a little, but we're nowhere near where we need to be.
Stigma. That is that word right there. Stigma with PTSD, stigma with alcohol, alcohol, caffeine, drugs, anything that, I mean, how many, not every big agency, not every small agency is getting drug tested. So, you know, you kind of bleed the lines, some way to keep this stress down, this adrenaline dump. And that is the difference between law enforcement and the civilian world. If you're on a construction site, yeah, some shit can happen. If you're here and there, some shit can happen. But when you're in this world where any second someone could pull a gun, any second pull a gun, pull a knife, punch you in the face, or anything, an allegation, you know, an allegation lands on your sergeant's desk, your captain's desk, your chief's desk. And next thing you know, you're like, your stomach's in a bind. You got the fucking shits. And I'm being graphic because this is what happens when your anxiety hits you. Mm-hmm. Your stomach's going crazy. Your head's going crazy. You're getting headaches. You're getting dizzy. your blood pressure spiking. All of this is happening because you chose to take a job that is putting your life on the line and you don't have that out. And anytime you want to talk about it, you get the stigma. You know, a chief can come forward and get a DUI. A captain can come forward and get a DUI and it'll be like, oh, it's fine. You know, he's management. He's this, he's that, you know, he's dealing with a lot. That first year officer, that first year deputy, that first year CO, that second year, third, fourth, fifth year, dealing with all this anxiety where and have never had to deal with it in their life. There is only one out. They're going to find something to counteract it, whether it's good or bad. Let's talk about you and like, how did you get to the point where you're like, I need to take this step and figure out a way to help?
Yeah, it was after probably the medics were called to me by my own coworkers on shift, you know, and medics in a county that I worked in. And so that I was on calls with all the time. That was mortifying. I mean, thankfully, I was able to, you know, at least relatively square my shit away and still promote to other things in law enforcement, had a full-ish career. You know, I was out right before that 20-year mark. But to me, that's still, I'm proud of what I was able to accomplish after that. But I was lucky, to be honest. Even after all that happened, I made it through the divorce. I just gave the house up, I think, which did alleviate some of the stress because I just walked away from it all. Where a lot of guys I know and gals, they fight tooth and nail, lawyers, custody battles. You know, I didn't have any kids in common, so I could have far worse, like a lot of my coworkers had over the years. But I've always liked reading. I started picking up every book I could on PTSD, on trauma, on vicarious trauma, on anxiety and all these different things. And it wasn't until I read probably my third or fourth book and I was like, holy shit, I'm ticking every, you know, I'm checking every box in this book as far as symptoms and everything else. And so I realized, okay, well, first of all, you can't, you know, self-medicate with alcohol to go to sleep. And then you wake up 2 hours later because your body's processing that alcohol and you're not going to have that deep REM sleep. Well, I didn't know any of that. So I must just not be able to sleep yet. So I'd go and drink more vodka to go back to sleep. You know, just stupid shit like that until you read and realize, well, you're rotting your body from the inside out. This isn't helping anything. And so just thankfully for me was self teaching myself through a lot of books that I read and self-help and psychology books. They also helped, you know, got me on this path, I think, and it piqued my interest. But yeah, I mean, cutting out a lot of alcohol, cutting out a shit ton of caffeine, really upping, you know, cardio workouts and stuff like that, forcing myself to get more sleep, alleviated panic attacks entirely, never had one again. And then later in life, you know, other good decisions and stuff like that too. But for me, thankfully, I went to therapy later in life for other reasons through the career. But at the time, just reading and educating myself helped me get through that. I was fortunate.
You brought up two things I want to hit. One is the checklist. Now, a lot of people don't understand that you may be anxiety ridden. You may be riddled with just all sorts of PTSD, anxiety and stuff, but there are a ton of really good checklists out there. I didn't realize I had some issues going on until I actually went online to the VA and I went down the checklist and I was like, oh, wow. Oh, wow. What is going on here? So you have that. And then you mentioned another word too, lucky. You were lucky to, you know, figure this out at a certain time. You were lucky to find another job. You were lucky to do this. I don't know how many times I've heard that from other people. They were lucky to get an out. I'm preaching to the choir, but it shouldn't be like that. It shouldn't be like you're lucky to find an out. You should have the support from the top down. And then, you know, you should be able to come forward. That is a critical issue within this profession. So lucky, and then I really, really, anybody out there who's suffering from what they may think is anxiety attacks could also be PTSD. But if check the VA websites, even if you're an LEO, go to the VA and check out the PTSD website, PTSD checklists and stuff like that. Just discover yourself so you don't have to be like, hey, I'm lucky I did this and stuff like that. You were dealing with canines as well for a lot of your career. And you know, a lot of people don't realize that canines can also get stressors. Yeah. They're adrenaline dumps. They're ins and outs. And so dealing with that must've been a very, dealing with your own stuff and then also dealing with your partner.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny, Laura's shirt, you know, drink coffee and pet dogs. You know, I think I like dogs more than most people, to be honest, which is one of the big reasons I got into canine in the first place. But I honestly, if there was a job out there to become a canine psychologist, I would jump all over that in a heartbeat and just deal with dogs the rest of my life and their PTSD. Cause I absolutely can attest to firsthand that they have it. But I don't think it should be any big surprise, though, either. I mean, we all have different varying levels of resiliency, right? And our breaking points, if you will, whatever it is. So why should animals be any different? I mean, I worked a canine for just shy of 7 years until I literally watched him get broken on a call. And I, at the same time, was starting to go through my own issues again after being in a second ambush shooting. And I was just done with patrol, but I was still at the time only in my late 30s. And so thankfully, I was able to test and get promoted to detective and get off the road and then also retire him. So both of our stress levels went down, at least for a little while, until my new job picked up some other issues. But I watched him go from a dog that could be on the range with gunfire and heel around, play with his toy and be living his best life, to after the second ambush shooting I was in, he was with me at the time, stuck in a car for an hour and a half, which is all hell breaking loose. And after that day, I knew enough through training and stuff that, okay, if a dog's in the shooting, whether he's shot or hears the shooting, whatever it may be, you need to get his ass back to the range and make sure that he's not going to have any residual effects from that. And I watched that dog that I've been training with for years at the range, who was happy-go-lucky, go from, yeah, no problem, gunfire, to any of you motherfuckers pull the trigger, I'm going to rip your face off. Because, I mean, the aggression was through the roof after that call. And I tried taking him to the range for several days, playing with him, you know, zero stress, and there was no getting back from that. I could shoot, and he was fine, but even my coworkers, who he knew, if they were standing next to me, my best friend on the job, would just shoot a couple rounds downrange. He wanted to attack them. I was like, well, this is going to be an issue, clearly, moving forward. And so, like I said, thankfully, I was going to have to retire him anyway, but thankfully I got promoted as well, and we both got off the street from that. But yeah, absolutely. Dogs, I know, I've seen, can suffer from the same issues that we do.
I was waiting for Laura. I had a question about being involved with a shooting.
Felt like I needed to raise my hand. I'm just like taking it in. I want to pet a dog now. I want to run and get my Great Dane. So, you know, I was talking to Jason a little bit about your experience and how in the past you and I talked about, you know, what do they consider a critical incident? What do they consider an actual, I was involved in a shooting, you know, and some agencies have this mentality of, well, if you didn't shoot, if you were just there, you know, if you didn't even, you know, aim, then you're good. Get back to work. And I thought it was a local thing. And then you mentioned that happening in your state. And I'm like, holy cow. So share a little bit about that, if you don't mind, and how that was perceived, if you can share.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Washington is probably one of the most liberal states in the nation too, right? So you would think we'd be up and up on our mental health. I mean, we say that we are for a lot of stuff, but my first one was pretty, low key ish, right? It was just myself and another deputy back around 2010 responded to a call, and it was an asshole we dealt with many times. So we knew he'd probably be a problem, but the terrain, the way it was, is he had the high ground on us, and he had dozens of acres of woods behind him, and we were on a main highway when we responded to the scene. And so as soon as we got out of our cars, he cranked off, I think, three or four rounds at us. And we already had our ARs out because we knew this guy was an asshole and it might escalate like that. But once the round skipped across the pavement in front of us, it was kind of dusk time too. We turned to where the fire came from, but he was already unasked into the woods. I mean, couldn't shoot back, didn't know who the hell else was up there, anyone with him. And so SWAT call out, airplane, everything else, we caught him. That wasn't a big deal. But the more recent one, the one in 2018, where my dog unfortunately got broken. Yeah, that one was just a routine 911 call I went to, and I was going to go alone. And one of my coworkers said, hey, you want a second? And normally I would say, you know, no, it's a welfare check or 911 hang up, no big deal. But, you know, we I don't know if you call it spidey sense, whatever it is. We all have that kind of that inside voice that sometimes says, yeah, you should probably bring some backup. There's something kind of weird about this call for whatever reason. I don't know. Right. And so I said, yeah, why don't you come with me? And so as soon as we got there, again, I something felt odd, even though it was just a simple 911 hang up. And so when I got there, I parked my SUV with my dog in it about 50 yards away from the residence, kind of, you know, put myself between my car and the residence. And called dispatch and said, hey, call in, have him come out and talk to us. Let us know what the issue is. And his response was, no, I'm not coming out. They need to come to my front door. Well, that shit's not happening, right? And so as soon as I relayed that through my dispatch to him, we heard one shot. And so we figured, okay, well, he just shot himself. You know, that's unfortunate, but it is what it is. So then we kind of left my dog in my car. In hindsight, now I wish I would move my car back further so my dog wasn't caught in this crossfire issue, but we thought it was already said and done. And so as we're kind of pieing off, it was a duplex. And so we wanted to let the neighbors know, you know, stay inside, we don't know what's going on type thing. Well, then seconds later, I mean, all hell broke loose. This guy had an arsenal of like seven guns in the house, handguns, long guns. And when it was all said and done, it was like 39 or 43, I forget, something like that, rounds he fired through the house, through the front windows and the front door at me and my partner. And again, couldn't return fire because A, we don't know what the hell we have, but B, does he have hostages, family in there? I have no idea. Never saw the guy, just bullets flying at us. And so, like Laura said, we never returned fire. So by policy, by Washington State standard, I wasn't in a shooting. I was in a shitty call, a shitty situation, but I wasn't in a shooting. And so after we got SWAT there and drones or anything else, introduced CS into the house, he did finally shoot himself. So never came out. He died there. But that was it, you know. And the funny thing when I look back now is after that was all said and done, and my partner and I were alone there for about 15 minutes, as Laura knows, rural county, even when your backup's hauling ass, it takes some time. And so when it was all said and done, there was probably 30 cops there or more, right? But still, it was a stressful situation. You know, when you feel bullets flying by your ear and your head, I was never in combat. I'm not former military. That was a first for me. And so when it was all said and done, that was it. All right, go home for the day. I remember my chief at the time coming up to me and saying, hey, you're scheduled to work tomorrow, right? Yeah, chief. It's like, you know, 9 p.m. now. I'm scheduled to be in at 6 in the morning. All right, well, you good? I even told Laura this. Like, what the hell are you going to say to your chief? Well, no, I'm kind of feeling fucked up right now. I'm going to go home and drink a fifth of whiskey because I'm happy to be alive, but my stress is through the roof. I need to kind of take it down a notch now. Oh yeah, chief, I'm fine. I'll be in tomorrow. And I was hungover, you know, but I wasn't in a shooting. And then later on when I'm investigating officer involved shootings as a detective, to know the amount of time and effort that goes into that, but only if you fire your weapon. When the situation could have been identical, the only difference was maybe I pulled my, well, my gun was obviously pulled. Maybe I shot one round. That was it. That doesn't really change the call at all. But the way it would have been handled after post shooting would have been night and day different. I'm off 2 weeks. I can go see a psychologist on the department's dime, you know, yada, yada, yada. And it's just that the system's broken. And that's one of many factors leading to the suicide rate being so high and the mental health issues amongst law enforcement is we got to take care of our people. And that is a prime situation of where I was not taken care of, but I also didn't have the balls to speak up either. Like probably a lot of people wouldn't have, because you don't want to disappoint your command staff, right?
Well, you don't have an out, right. You know, you don't have that out. You don't have another job lined up. You don't have, I mean, this is your life. This is your career. It's not like, hey, you know what? I'm going to go and get a job tomorrow. Right. We know jobs are not easy to get. It takes time. The other thing too, is I really think someone should write a book called Routine. You know, you show up to a routine call, routine this, routine that. You're involved in a critical incident, life-altering critical incident. And you're like, huh, now I don't have any support just because I didn't pull my gun or I didn't pull the trigger. You know, your gun's pulled. You're ready. The slack's coming off your trigger. And you're ready to go. Maybe you're not in the same position as someone else that could pull the trigger. But because you didn't pull that trigger, now you don't have the support. You don't have the agency saying, hey, you know what? We're going to send you all to the shrink. Or we're going to send you all to a mental health. We're all going to send you to the critical incident response team or whatever. Everybody involved, anytime that round comes within any part of your body or anywhere in the near zone, bullets travel. They could travel anywhere, anytime. They could ricochet. They could kill. It doesn't mean you're not feeling the same thing just because you didn't pull your trigger. So that is one thing that absolutely needs to be fixed.
Well, and you know, I'm going to jump in too, because I mean, take it a step further. What if it's not even a shooting? What if it's not a barricaded subject? What if it's not that SWAT call? You know, you have so many positions, and even as a detective, what if you work in crimes against children, sex crimes, internet crimes against children? You put someone in a situation where you're seeing the literally the worst of the worst for any amount of time. At what point do you think that person needs to, let's call it, decompress, you know, and just kind of unload all that stuff you have been packing, you know. And another thing I also think about sometimes in this profession is, does it really take, well, I've been doing this for 10 years, 15 years, 20, 30 years. I mean, does it really? Or can you be a year, 2 years in, and your perception, maybe your childhood, maybe a combination of things, you know, have you seen life and things and experiences different than somebody that, you know, like I had a coworker tell me one time, oh, I can look at, you know, child abuse pictures and cases and work them all day, every day. It doesn't bother me. And he had a kid and he had been doing it for, I don't know, 15 years at the time. And I'm looking at it like, huh, really? Because I'm not trying to sign up for this any longer than I have to. And then he doesn't have to show up as, you know, let me go home and drink either. Because I never did. You know, I wore Crimes Against Children for years. I don't know, you know, how much I've shared. But even when I was working those cases, you know, 500 cases or however many, and I would go home, I never picked up a bottle. But then it wasn't until years later, I'm like, you know, 3-4 years after I did that assignment, then I'm like, responding to, what is it, Jason? A routine call. And I'm thinking about that kid from 4 years ago, 5 years ago, like, oh crap, how's little, you know, Johnny doing or whatever. So I think those two areas, I don't believe that, you know, administration really gets. What do you think, Justin?
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I actually want to touch on something you both said independently from one another, but Laura, you're spot on with, it's dependent on people's upbringing, their past, their childhood, their experiences, all of those things, right? There's a thing in the medical field, the ACE scores, the adverse childhood experience scores. If you've been sexually assaulted as a child or physically abused, whatever it is, you know, your scores can go up depending on your childhood. That may or may not build one's resilience, right? Going into the military or law enforcement or both, like a lot of people are. I like to, you know, explain it or describe it as like everyone's walking around inside of our brain is like a cup, you know, teacup, whatever you want, a coffee cup, whatever you want to envision. And every routine call that we go to that turns shitty, or every hard call you go to, death you see, whatever it may be, a little bit of liquid is poured into that cup, a little bit of trauma, if you will, right? Depending on your upbringing, your background, your level of resilience, and how much you can take, everyone's cups are different sizes. And so, to that point, you and I, Laura, could be working in the same agency. We could be the same age, be in the same job, the same shift, and go to every single call together the same. I might break before you, or you might break. Or neither of us will break. You don't know, because we don't know what everyone else's levels of experience and trauma, how much they can handle, and how much until that cup spills over, you know, whatever you want to use for an acronym. But I mean, it's very true. And then to Jason's point earlier, you mentioned in critical incidents where, you know, everyone should just be sent to therapy or a wellness visit, whatever it is. I've been arguing that for the last couple of years since I really got into this is mandatory wellness checks. Some agencies have wellness teams and training and whatever. What is that? Most of it is still death by PowerPoint. You might go to in-service and do 4 hours firearms, 4 hours DT, and get a 30-minute PowerPoint on mental health. What good is that? I mean, maybe a little bit, sure, better than nothing. But we need hands-on training, yoga, mindfulness training by professionals, not cops in our agency that might do it as a hobby. But mandatory wellness checks. What do we all have to do every month or every 2 months, depending on your agency, is you have to go sit for a full day and do whatever the required training is, your EVOC training, your first aid CPR or whatever. Why in the hell can't you throw in 1 hour of that 8 hour day or 10 hour day, whatever shift you depending upon you at your work, a 1 hour wellness check, contract out with a psychologist, a culturally competent law enforcement psychologist, and mandate that across the board. And I don't mean your patrol. I mean, your patrol, your detectives, your administrators, your sheriffs, your police chiefs, lieutenants, everyone is mandated. Like you are mandated to do ground fighting, whatever it is, you go do a wellness check once a quarter, once a month, whatever it is. Even if you're fine, okay, you're getting paid to be there. It's an hour out of your day. What is it going to hurt you to go talk to a professional? And then guess what? During that hour conversation that you're getting paid for on your mandatory work time, some shit might come up. You might just have a conversation with that psychologist, and all of a sudden they pull something out of you because they're a trained professional and they know what the hell they're doing. That, oh, like Laura mentioned, she had no issue doing those, looking at the child abuse material. Then all of a sudden, fast forward, year to call years down the road and, oh, what the hell? Well, guess what? You're already in that hour-long mandated wellness check. Why don't you talk about it? And if it's mandated, everyone's going to get better. Everyone's going to get at least better-ish, get help with the issues or lack thereof, issues they may not be aware they have of yet. But the biggest thing is, like we talked about earlier, what's that big scary word? Stigma, right? If everyone is mandated to go to therapy, wellness check, it's therapy, right? What stigma is there? Oh, do you hear so-and-so is going to therapy? Big fucking deal. We all do every month at in-service training. Well, where's the stigma now if everyone's going, including your command staff?
I really like that idea. You know, get everybody involved. Make them involved. You know, make that part of, you know, we go through all this training, tons of training, in-services. We go through our basic academies and everything. Everybody, and you brought up an incredible point that it really bothers me because we are a line item, but we're all not the same. You know, that line item fills up. And then that cup you said about the stressors, it's not just the cup of that, it's experience. You have a cup of experience.
Yeah.
Everybody starts out with an empty cup. They may have some life experiences and stuff like that. But when you put these two things together, you have a line item and you have a cup of experience. You can't just replace someone. You know, I was in 1811, I was in 1801 in the US, 1896, all sorts of different codes in the government. We're all not the same. You know, you have a squad of people, you know, maybe one really knows what the hell they're doing. Two are really good at their job. Three are great support. Three or four are complete waste of time. And one is just, he shouldn't even show up to work. You know, not all those people, you can't take one, like, you know, the guy who doesn't show up for work, shouldn't show up for work. He should really just stay home. He can't replace number one.
Right.
He can never replace number one. It's not just line items, you know, and when you bring it up this point of get everybody involved, then maybe when number one and number two, three, four, five, the people that you really want on the job are having these issues before you lose them to another agency, before you lose them to just quitting, or before you, God forbid, you lose them to death, to suicide, maybe you get everybody involved and you're not going to have retention problems and you're not going to have the death problems. I mean, you're always going to have them, but you're going to limit them. That's my soapbox.
Yeah.
Well, Jason, how about this though? You mentioned, what about that person, you know, not showing up to work? Tell me this is just not me. Tell me how much you guys love the fact that if I need a sick day, I need to be sick, you know? So it's either I'll bring a doctor's note because I got a cold or I have a dentist appointment. But if I need a mental health day because I'm not feeling well on an actual body part, then, you know, no, you're not sick. You're not, you know, you don't need a mental health day or, you know, there is no note. There is no, like, what do you do, right? So, oh, you know, it's HIPAA. We can't talk about this. We can't talk about that. And so do I lie? Do I just say, hey, you know, feeling sick today, calling out? Or shouldn't it be just okay to call my supervisor and say, hey, I can't make it to work today. You know, I'm taking a mental health day. End of the conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that needs to be normalized. But I mean, to your point though, too, is I suffered a bunch of on the job injuries. Part of it, I'm just a clumsy individual, but also being a canine handler in Washington State, if you've ever gone on a hike or trekked through our woods, there's a lot of down trees and a lot of things to trip over. And so I've broken my hand a couple of times, broken my leg, all kinds of fun shit. And I like a lot of us, if you're on desk duty, it's mind numbing. It's terrible. And you're hearing all these calls come out. Your people are running out of the squad room and you're sitting there with your leg up on a chair or whatever, taking just one bullshit call after another, and you're not really doing anything. So what do we all want to do when we're physically injured? You want to rush that rehab, get that physical therapist to sign off and say you're good for full duty. And at least for me, I've done that, especially when I was in canine. I'd still bring my dog to work and he was just running around the squad room, sticking his head in garbage cans. He was bored. He's a freaking dog. He wants me back on the street. And so those two injuries I suffered while I had him is I really pushed and fought to get back to full duty when I knew that I wasn't 100%. But in my mind, I'm like, yeah, I got coworkers. I have a dog. If I'm going to get a fight, I'll just hit my door popper. My dog's going to come out. I don't really need both my hands yet. It's fine. But to my supervisor's credit, in those incidents, they were like, no, you're still fucked up. Your finger's still like wonky. You can't come back to work. Okay. So why, when they know that I was just in a critical incident or whatever, or you got a coworker that comes to work and that you smell booze on them, they're probably not in a good spot mentally, are they? Well, why do we ignore that? Why can't we talk about that? Like we can talk about a physical injury that, no, hey buddy, you're not good enough yet. Let's get you rehab. Let's go work out, get you better or whatever. Our brain is also part of our body. It's you know, an appendage, if you will, like a finger or a leg, whatever it is. So if it's damaged, why can't we get it fixed or get aid for it and not be scrutinized about it? And why can't it just be normal? Like, well, your leg's in two pieces. You should probably take some time off work. Well, if you're going through a divorce, you just lost a kid to cancer, whatever it may be, why isn't that treated the same way? Right.
The brain, it's the most important thing. I mean, let's say it's one of the most important things because it's all a big machine. You know, the military, it took two wars and 20 years from them to finally say it's okay to have PTSD.
Right.
It's okay to get help. It's okay. You have commanders coming out and saying, I have PTSD. You have generals coming out now and saying, I have PTSD. How many of these people have rose through the ranks who may have mental health issues, but because they're rising through the ranks and they're always looking at that next step in their career, they don't want to talk about it. What you really need to affect change is to have someone from the top start saying, hey, you know what? My brain is a little broken. It's not irreparable. It can be fixed. I need help. And empower every one of his leadership below them. Supervisors should be able to check in on their people. Hey, you know, I noticed you've been calling in sick a lot lately. And is there anything I could do? Do you want to see someone? Do you need to change assignments? Do you need a little extra sleep? Do you need something? Now, granted, manpower issues are always going to be a problem, especially with the smaller departments. But if you have a solid supervisor, they should be able to check in on their people and then go to their captain, go to their chief and say, hey, you know what? Such and such, you know what? Let's lay off them a little bit. Let's not bust their balls. Let's fix them so they don't, one, leave. Don't break themselves to where they're not repairable. And three, they don't end up in the grave.
Yeah. 100%. And so how do we get there? You know, the bigger issue, unfortunately, I think, and then Laura and I talked about this before, is some of our command staff who probably should have retired many years ago, but they're hanging on to those stripes or whatever it is. And a lot of them too. And I've had some that I worked for, they worked the road for like a couple of years and then they decided to get on that promotion chain. And now all of a sudden they're leading an agency, but they've probably never even been in a fist fight, let alone a shooting or worked any, you know, child crime or anything like that. So they're probably completely fine. And so to ask them to understand this and mandate wellness checks and all this, they're going to say, well, especially if they're an old school male mentality, you know, it's like gonna be like, you may as well go talk to the planner about this because you're not going to get anywhere. So that's the bigger, scarier issue. And so how do you fix that? Well, it's going to take time until they retire out, I think. But if agencies start promoting up their junior sergeants and stuff, and they're doing an effective job at that and normalizing all this stuff with them, then as they move up in the ranks, then I think, like to your point, it won't be such a weird thing. It'll be normalized in the agencies. But I think also, police academies from day one need to be teaching this stuff, implementing this stuff, normalizing this stuff and everything else. I remember going, you know, when I went through in 2003, there was no talk of this. They would just, you know, scream at you and spit in your face, probably similar to boot camp back in the day when you went through, Jason. And, you know, you're a piece of shit. You're a boot. You know, we've all been in shootings and we've had six divorces and we're alcoholics, but we're badasses. And so our generation, unfortunately, was brought up on that. But there's an easy fix to that. If it starts the day one in the academy, is these recruits are treated like humans. You still got to be taught the job and weeded out if you can't handle the stress and being in a fight and shooting and all that. That's fine. But what about after, like, the mock scenes in the academy? After you're in a use of force, you're in a shooting with some munitions that's kind of realistic and stuff like that. What should be done after that? Immediate debriefs. Have psychologists in the academy, have peer support teams, have shooting buddies, all that. If it's if it's brought to the forefront on day one in the academy, then fast forward to 10 years from now, you're in a critical incident. Oh, well, back in the academy, yeah, we would practice these mindfulness techniques they taught us afterwards, and we would take mental health days, and we would go see a psychologist because they taught us in the academy that's how you get better because it's scientifically proven. So if you start teaching that from day one, I think with the command staff changing as time goes on, and also the new recruits coming up, going through the chain of commands and stuff like that, my hope anyway, you know, 5, 10, especially 20 years from now, this will be a mute point, but things have to change. Again, in Washington State, I went up to our basic training academy about a year ago. I'm out of law enforcement now, but I have a stake in this game. I don't want people to go through what I went through, what a lot of my friends and coworkers have gone through. And so I heard that our academy is teaching mental health the officers now. And I was like, cool, can I come up and watch the class? They're like, yeah, of course. I've got connections and stuff still in law enforcement. It was a 2-hour class. They get one time. And most of it was how to deal with people in crisis. I'm like, what the fuck? No, our mental health, not people on the street. We get that through CIT and all kinds of other bullshit training we'll go through later. Again, Washington State, pretty forward-thinking, liberal state. We're not even getting it yet. Like, it's not that difficult, people. Let's get him some professionals and psychologists and teach mindfulness and resiliency and psychology and talking to therapists, and all of these things are normal. You're going to have the adrenaline and cortisol dumps, and here's why, and here's what's going to happen to you. It's going to suck, but here's how you get through it. We're teaching great techniques and tools for kicking people's asses and shooting them and tasing them and giving first aid and now de-escalation. Sure. But what about ourselves that are still seeing on average, if you do a 20-year career, where they say, I think 300 to 600 critical incidents we're going to come across, as opposed to your average citizen might see 2 or 3 in their entire life. I mean, it's not even apples and oranges. So why isn't more being done at the basic academy training level is my question. I can go out of that soapbox all day, but.
Well, you know, I made a couple notes here. One of them is $2 signs, money. Everything comes down to money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every extra day, every extra hour you spend in academy. But that's the other aspect of this whole situation is, let's look at it from a monetary instance. Retention, recruitment, everything comes down to money. But who really approves the money? City councils, mayors, the whole bureaucracy above the police station, above the sheriff. Money. If you get buy-in from council members, you get buy-in from the civilians who don't deal with this. You already said it before that they don't deal with these critical incidents. They have no idea what someone in law enforcement goes through. Absolutely none.
Right.
But if you get buy-in from these council people who are going to approve the budget and say, okay, the next time Chief so-and-so is writing a grant, hey, we're going to write a grant for mental health. We're going to write a grant for this. We're going to write a grant for anything to do with like physical fitness machines. Anything where that's not just like tasers and new guns and new this and new that, but we're going to do something that's going to help the mental health, the physical health of the officers, the deputies that they're in charge with. Get the buy-in from the councils. Get the buy-in from the people who are approving these budgets. I think that's kind of another aspect of this whole situation, is to start looking at it that way. It took a lot of push, but now there's laws that are on the books going at the federal level that's showing that suicide is now a line of duty death for a lot of law enforcement. A lot of people are like, well, that's really touchy-feely. No, it's not, because what it does is provides benefits to loved ones. So if you start putting the mental health aspect in it, the monetary aspect of it, a suicide line of duty death is now going to cost these council people money. Unfortunately, it's a truth. And you're going to tell them, hey, you know what? Before we get to this point where we're going to have to provide hiring bonuses for people, or we're going to have to provide line of duty death benefits to someone who commits suicide, why don't we start looking at the mental health aspect and do it from a monetary point and affect change at that level too? So, hey, you know what? I'll write a letter today. Let's do it.
Yeah. I mean, you're spot on, and it's not a difficult chore or task to accomplish. You just need the right people to have the knowledge and the expertise, or at least if they don't know where to reach out and get those answers to. I mean, there's plenty of signs and evidence out there that shows that this is a real thing. We're losing people at suicide. The rates aren't going down. And why? It's because of the nonstop trauma, and you're not getting enough time off. You're not getting the resources and all that. So yes, it's a budget, it's a monetary issue, but what does it cost? Like you just touched on the hiring incentives. I think Seattle's up to like $50,000 for a new hire now. I mean, come on. So not only that, but what does it cost to train a brand new, you know, snot-nosed boot out of the academy up to a level that they can work and be effective on their own? I mean, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. So if we're only asking these council people or county commissioners, whatever it is, for a $50,000 or $100,000 budget to get mandatory wellness checks and psychologists on staff for all of our staff, but guess what? That's probably going to help retain all of them, so we don't have to do these hiring incentives and then train people and academy costs and all that. What's going to cost us more in the long run? It's going to be losing people and having to hire and pay incentives all day. So why not? Let's pony up the money up front and worry about those retention rates and not having to lose people to suicide and substance abuse and DUIs and DVs and everything else, which is still happening.
And Justin, it's not just critical incidents. It's not just shootings. It's not just someone's going to beat your ass. Sometimes it's just piss poor management.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just piss poor management. And if you could get a psych or someone, mental health professional on retainer, so someone can go and vent without using alcohol or just venting and bitching to coworkers, but someone that can go there and get some sort of like mental resolution. So then they're not looking for jobs. They could enjoy their job, but then also have these chiefs and captains and lieutenants go see the mental health people as well.
Yeah.
Get them to be like, hey, you know what? Maybe you're kind of fucked up and you need to take care of your people.
Yeah.
Laura, you got anything else?
No, I think that, like Justin said, if you don't know where to start, what to do, reach out. I know I had maybe a 30-minute conversation with him once, because I was like, look, I'm currently working at a very small department. I've never seen anything mental health related be addressed. Where do I start? It needs to happen. We have a lot of new officers and, you know, I mean, literally a year or less, they have already attended 3 funerals in their time in this career. He gave me some pointers. Did a little bit of research, used some agencies that are already doing great things in that arena and presented it. And hey, 30 minutes I was awarded. I'll take it. So brought in a professional. She talked for about, I don't know, maybe 40 minutes. And then has someone talk about physical wellness. Like you were saying, you know, go for a hike, go to the gym, practice, you know, martial arts or, you know, CrossFit, whatever you're into. And I was so grateful for my 45 minutes during in service. So if you don't know where to start, just ask. You know, Justin was super kind and gave me some pointers and kind of told me how I could even present this to my chief, and it worked. So we did that in my super tiny agency. And I think if you just look for, you know, where to start, it can happen. It really can.
Justin, I really appreciate you coming on, brother. I'm looking forward to continuing our discussion and really maybe affect some change. Why not?
Something's got to change, you know? So I'll keep talking to whoever I can and venting or whatever else I need to do. Yeah, it's worth it. So